أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Verse number 221 أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ولا تنكحوا المشركات حتى يؤمن ولا أمة مؤمنة خير من مشركة ولو أعجبتكم ولا تنكحوا المشركين حتى يؤمنوا ولا عبد مؤمن خير من مشرك ولو أعجبكم أولئك يدعون إلى النار والله يدعو إلى الجنة والمغفرة بإذنه ويبين آياته للناس لعلهم يتذكرون Do not marry idolatresses until they embrace faith. A faithful slave girl is better than an idolatress, though she should impress you. And do not marry your girls to idolaters until they embrace faith. A faithful slave is better than an idolater, though he should impress you. Those invite to the fire, but Allah invites to paradise and pardon by his will. And he clarifies his signs for the people so that they may take admonition. Now, last week we talked about the meaning of marrying slave girls. It's not that you own a slave girl and you become mahram with each other. It means that someone else has a slave girl and you go and propose, and with the permission of the owner, you marry with each other. That's the meaning of marrying with the slave girls. And the verse is very clear that the marriage between a believer and a non-believer is not permissible from both sides, whether a woman to a man or a man to a woman, mushrik. And mushrik, of course, includes kafir in the sense of atheist, someone who does not believe in God at all, by priority, because mushrik is someone who believes in God and other gods as well, while a kafir does not believe in God at all. So by priority, it includes that. Whether this includes Ahlul Kitab or not, we'll discuss it later. Now, about the Sha'nul Nuzul, the situation in which the verse was revealed, I mentioned one story last week about Marthad ibn Abi Marthad, who went to Mecca, and they had some sort of friendship with a woman before, and that woman called him to go and stay the night with her, and he refused. Then the lady offered to marry him, but he said, I have to ask the Prophet about it, and the verse was revealed. Another Sha'nul Nuzul is mentioned. Now, these incidents may probably have happened one after another, and then the verse has been revealed to cover all of them or to give the answer about all of them. Another Sha'nul Nuzul is mentioned about Abdullah ibn Rawaha. Abdullah ibn Rawaha, of course, was a very prominent companion of the Prophet from Ansar, who was martyred in the Battle of Mu'ta with Ja'far ibn Abi Talib. He had a black slave girl. And once that black slave girl made a mistake, and he became very angry, slapped her. And then he regretted it hugely, that why did I slap this slave girl? And he went to the Prophet and said, Ya Rasulullah, what should I do? I regret what I did. I slapped my slave girl, and you tell me what to do to somehow atone for it. The Prophet asked, is she a faithful woman, a faithful girl? He said, yes, of course. Does she pray and fast? Yes. So the Prophet somehow showed his disapproval of what he had done, in the sense that you do not have the right to do this with your slave girls. Now, I will come to this beating a little while later with a slave girl like that. So the Prophet said, she is a believer. Why you did that? And he became very upset, and he said, Ya Rasulullah, now that you have said that, I free her and I will marry her. though this was an honor, of course, for a slave girl to be freed and marry with Abdullah ibn Rawaha. And when his family heard about it, they started to blame her. That, why you have married with your own slave girl? You freed her, you married her. Why you did that? And then this verse was revealed that وَلَأَمَةٌ مُؤْمِنَةٌ خَيْرٌ مِنْ مُشْرِكَةٌ وَلَوْ أَعْجَبَتْكُمْ. A slave girl who is a believer is better than a free woman who is not a believer. Now, in passing about this beating, because inshallah, if one day in several years ahead we can do Surah An-Nisa, we'll discuss about verse number 33 or 34 in Surah An-Nisa about beating. But it shows that this was not the habit. I mean, beating women, here is of course a slave girl, was not a habit at the time. And the verse of the Quran which says that even if you fear that they would disobey you with respect to your relations, then فَعِذُوهُنَّ وَحْجُرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ وَضْرِبُوهُنَّ is actually putting a hindrance on the way for the very rough attitude of some people. We know that some of the people, especially in Mecca, they had a very rough attitude towards women. This is especially reported from the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, which, I don't know whether these are true or not. It may be just allegedly made against him, that he was very rough. And for example, in Musnad Ahmad ibn Majah, Ash'as ibn Qais says that one night I was a guest of the caliph, the second caliph, and in the middle of the night, without any reason, he went and started to beat his wife, and then came back, and I asked, what happened? He said, no, don't ask me, because I heard the Prophet, peace be on him, saying that a man is never asked why he beats his wife. Now, if these types of narration are correct, then we have to put aside these verses of the Quran which talk about it. And these type of incidents, like for example, Abdullah ibn Rawaha, it is reported from Hudhayfa as well that he had the same incident and he regretted what he did. It was just out of rage and out of anger. And he freed his slave girl and married her again the same way. All this show that This type of mentality has come from the harsh attitude of some, especially some of the Muhajirin. The Ansar were very lenient, of course, towards. In Medina, the situation was very different. In Mecca, of course, the situation was not good, and that's why this verse about putting hindrances for such an act came in Surah An-Nisa. Anyhow, that was just in passing. So here the verse is very clear that marrying mushrikat and mushrikeen is not allowed for the faithful people. And this is a very clear law in the Quran. Now, a married couple, one of them becomes mushrik or atheist or disbeliever while they are in wedlock, while they are in marriage. Here in Tabian, Sheikh Tusi gives some fatwa about it as well, because of course the verse is talking about the prohibition of marriage in that sense. He says that first of all, fil ayah dilalatun ala jawaz nikah al amat al mu'minah. The first thing is that it is permissible to marry slave girls who belong to other people. And you go, as I said, this ruling is not related to our time at all. It's just about that time. But it was interesting that faith was above all social classes and status. This is very important. Faith was above all social status. So if a slave girl or a slave man was faithful, was above everyone else who did not believe in God or who were atheists, things like that, regardless what social status they had. So this is a very important matter. And in Surah An-Nisa, we have another verse about marriage with slave girls, and that is وَمَنْ لَمْ يَسْتَطِعْ مِنْكُمْ طَوْلًا أَنْ يَنْكِحَ الْمُحْصَنَاتِ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ فَمِمَّا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ مِنْ فَتَيَاتِكُمْ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ. If some of you do not have the means to marry a free woman, then go and propose to slave girls and marry them. Then it says, ذَلَكَ لِمَنْ خَشِيَ الْأَنَةَ مِنْكُمْ. This is only for those who fear that they cannot control themselves in sexual desire. Otherwise, it's better to wait and marry a free woman. Now, here, which one has sort of priority over the other? Sheikh says that, well, that is for istihbab, or it's makruh to marry a slave girl who belongs to another person, because it becomes very, it brings lots of complications, legal complications, and in relationship to the owner and the husband and things like that. But it is not a prohibition. This verse is very clear that it doesn't matter whether you are rich or you are poor, you can do that. As we see Abdurrah ibn Rawaha, for example, did marry her own slave girl. Of course, he freed him. The case is a bit different. The second thing that he mentions is that when a couple marry are living with each other, and one of them, they are both mushrik, one of them believes. For example, the husband believes, becomes a Muslim, and the wife remains a mushrika. Or vice versa. The wife becomes a Muslim, and the husband becomes a mushrik. He says that they would separate from each other. The marriage is annulled completely. There's no need for divorce or anything like that. It's annulled. However, according to Sunni fiqh, or the scholars, Sunni scholars in Sheikh Tusi's time, they said that even if for one second, if they both convert to Islam together, the marriage remains as, they don't need to make a new marriage. The marriage remains as it was. If, however, for example, the wife converts 1 second before the husband, the marriage is annulled. Well, it's very difficult, especially that time it was a very difficult situation. I mean, because conversion was high and people had different sort of feelings towards conversion, wives, husbands. It was very difficult because the marriage was annulled immediately. And of course, it doesn't happen these days, although very rarely it may happen, but in those days it was very difficult. However, Sheikh Tusi says that our opinion about this is very different. We say that if one of them converts, the wife, whether the husband or wife, the wife should keep the iddah. And during that iddah, which is almost 3 months, if the other spouse believes, the marriage would remain intact. They will have continued their old marriage. But if after the expiration of the iddah, the spouse does not believe, then the marriage is annulled and they will be separated. Now, the other thing about this verse is that does it include Ahlul Kitab or not? And can we call Ahlul Kitab mushrik? We know that in some places, for example, in some instances, we can attribute shirk to Ahlul Kitab. Like, for example, believing that Jesus is a partner of God, whether son of God or part of God or whatever, is shirk. Or as, for example, the Jews believe that Uzair was son of God. وَقَالَتَ الْيَهُودُ أُزَيْرٌ ابْنُ اللَّهِ. They said, أُزَيْر is son of God. So it makes them mushrik. Apparently, Sheikh Tusi says, yes, this include Ahlul Kitab as well. They are mushrik as well. And what we have in Surah Ma'idah, الْيَوْمُ أُحِلَّ لَكُمُ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَطَعَامُ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابِ حِلٌّ لَكُمْ وَطَعَامُكُمْ حِلٌّ لَهُمْ وَالْمُحْسَنَاتُ مِنَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابِ من قبلكم. And the women from Ahlul Kitab today is become halal, it has become halal for you to marry them. Now, he says that this ayah is about temporary marriage. It's not about the permanent marriage. And therefore, it somehow specifies, it gives a sort of rejoinder to this verse, however the verse is general. All other scholars, or majority of scholars, they say that Ahlul Kitab cannot be regarded as mushrik, although they have some elements of shirk in them, but shirk has many different degrees. In Al-Mizan, Allama Tabatabai says, for example, yeah, one degree of shirk is that you believe in partners for God, polytheism. This is one level of shirk. There's another level of shirk that we have in Ahlul Kitab, who believe that Jesus is Son of God or things like that. There's another level of shirk that can be found in believers as well, like, for example, thinking that there are independence. There is independence in these asbab and musabbabat, the causes that Allah has made for things to come to us. We do not attribute it to God. We attribute things to these causes. This is shirk as well. Or a deeper type of shirk still is there, that, for example, you become negligent of God and think about other things. This is another degree of shirk. We do not call these people mushrikun. Otherwise, everyone should be called mushrik. So he says mushrik is a very specific term used in the Quran for the polytheists, especially the polytheists of Hijaz, the time of the Prophet. We cannot extend it to other degrees of disbelief. And therefore, the Quran has separated between the two. Like, for example, لَمْ يَكُنِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ وَالْمُشْرِكِينَ مُنْفَكِّينَ. So those who are disbelievers from Ahlul Kitab are separated from mushrikeen. And therefore, the ayah does not include Ahlul Kitab. And the conclusion is that marrying the women of Ahlul Kitab is permissible. Now, according to Sunni fiqh, that is the rule. Marrying the women of Ahlul Kitab is permissible, not marrying the men. Of course, women can be married if they are Ahlul Kitab, but women, or Muslim women, cannot marry men of Ahlul Kitab. This is a ijma'i. This is old, unanimously, every faqih in Sunni and Shi'i fiqh believe in that. However, in the Shi'i jurisprudence, there is a disagreement among the fuqaha with regards to this marriage of Muslim men with Ahlul Kitab women, whether it's allowed without any condition, or it's allowed only in temporary marriage, or it includes both temporary and permanent marriage. Here in Tahrir al-Wasila, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi says that لا يجوز للمسلم تزبيج غير الكتابية من أصناف الكفار ولا المرتد عن فترة أو عن ملة. It's not permissible for a Muslim to marry non-Muslims who are not Ahlul Kitab. Non-Muslims who are not Ahlul Kitab, whoever they are murtad, or they are born as non-Muslims, or they have been Muslims and they have went back in their faith, whether they were converts and went back, whether they were born Muslims and went back, is not permissible. However, about the Ahlul Kitab from Jews and Christians, we have different views among the fuqaha in Shia faith. One, the most famous is that it is not permissible in permanent marriage, but is permissible in temporary marriage. The other view is that it's not permissible at all. The other view is that it is permissible completely, whether permanent or temporary. And he says that my view is that it is permissible in temporary marriage, but not permissible in permanent marriage. However, when we come to the fatwa of other fuqaha nowadays, this is something which is somehow we have some issues in our modern life, because there are Muslim boys who want to marry Christian girls permanently, not temporarily. And in Sunni fiqh, there is no problem. In Shi'i fiqh, there is problem. However, as we have the fatwa of modern scholars, apparently there shouldn't be any problem with that. First of all, Ayatollah Khoi, rahmatullah alayhi, believed that there is no problem, although ihtiyat mustahab was not to marry permanently with a Jew or Christian, but he says that there is no problem with that. And Ayatollah Zanjani, who's still a living marja, he says that there is no problem in permanent marriage with non-Muslim Ahlul Kitab girls. Ayatollah Nuri says it's permissible. And Ayatollah Safi says it's permissible. Ayatollah Sistani has ihtiyat-e wajib, as Ayatollah Khamenei has ihtiyat-e wajib. Now, when we put all these things together, we come to the conclusion that there is no problem, because there are some living fuqaha who allows it, who allow it, and the other fuqaha who do not allow it have ihtiyat-e wajib, and therefore someone can refer to these living fuqaha who are permitting it. So therefore, the ayah is only about the mushrikeen, not about Ahlul Kitab. And Ahlul Kitab, according to our modern understanding of fiqh, according to our living fuqaha, it's permissible to marry women from Ahlul Kitab permanently as well, even if it's ihtiyat-e wajib, and we can refer to other fuqaha in that. The continuation of the verse says that وَلَا تُنْكِحُ الْمُشْرِكَاتِ حَتَّى يُؤْمِنُ وَلَا عَبْدٌ مُؤْمِنْ خَيْرٌ مِّن مُشْرِكٍ وَلَوْ أَعْجَبَكُمْ. I said أَعْجَبَكُمْ means even if you fall in love, because ijab is to be impressed by someone. That's the meaning of what we contemporarily call love. أُولَٰئِكَ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ. Why I do not allow that? Why I say you should not do it? Because they call towards fire. Now, this is a very strong expression. That, for example, a lady who is not a Muslim and not Ahlul Kitab, they call you towards fire. How is it possible? I mean, for example, a Muslim man marries an atheist girl, and they live together happily, and each of them believe in whatever they believe, and they do not somehow discuss it. And what does it mean that they call towards fire? أُولَٰئِكَ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ. Apparently, what the verse is trying to say, which is later on has a rejoinder saying that Allah wants to explain for you why. As I said, whenever Allah gives a command or prohibition, then he mentions, I want to explain for you why I have made that, despite the fact that because he's our creator, we have to follow without question, but Allah wants to explain for us. وَيُبَيِّنُ اللَّهُ لِلنَّاسِ لَعَلَّهُمْ وَيُبَيِّنُ آيَاتِهِ لِلنَّاسِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَكَّرُونَ. Allah explains his communications for the people, so that they are reminded. Now, the reason is, as Fakhruddin Razi has mentioned very nicely, I haven't seen this in other explanations, commentators. Fakhruddin Razi mentions very, he says that when this sort of relation is established, mahabba, uns, intimation, love, of course, is created. And when you love someone, you somehow approve of their ways. You think that, well, it doesn't matter. Well, what's the problem with it? Why should, for example, I condemn what she or he is doing? And in that sense, you gradually you lose your hold on your values and your belief. And you somehow see kufr, disbelief, not believing in God, as something which is not very harmful. I see this person, she or he is a very nice person. Why should, of course, I think that God is going to punish him or her? Why should I think that we are better than them? Gradually, the mindset changes. And it's very interesting. Nar, the fire, is actually the embodiment of these values and these beliefs and such things. They call you towards it. It doesn't say that necessarily it happens, but because this is a sort of general pattern, I forbid it for you. أُولَٰئِكَ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ. They call towards fire. They call not in the sense that, for example, every morning when the atheist's wife wakes up and says, come and believe in what I believe, or do not believe in God, or things like that. No. Gradually, we lose touch with our base of belief, and these things would gradually cause us towards different types of ideas and mindset, which the embodiment of it is fire. أُولَٰئِكَ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ وَاللَّهُ يَدْعُو إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ وَالْمَغْفِرَةِ بِإِذْنِهِ. And Allah calls towards paradise and maghfirah with His permission. Now, this is, again, a very interesting expression which needs some explanation. Before that, you see how the verses of the Quran are phrased in a way that Allah, like a very kind and caring friend, is telling us why I don't want you to do these things, why you have to avoid such things, for example. Not because I am your Lord, not because I command, no, because I want to explain for you, وَيُبَيِّنُ آيَاتِهِ لِلنَّاسِ. I want to explain these for the people so that they understand why I am giving these injunctions. Now, the verse should have been in like this, أُولَٰئِكَ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ. They call towards fire. وَهَٰؤُلَاءِ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ وَالْمَغْفِرَةِ. And these believers call you towards Jannah and Maghfira, isn't it? So the disbelievers call you towards fire, and the believers call you towards Jannah and Maghfira. However, it says, وَاللَّهُ يَدْعُو إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ وَالْمَغْفِرَةِ بِإِذْنِهِ. Now, one thing is clear, that no one can actually call us towards God or towards Jannah and Maghfirah except Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says Allah, by actually making such command, giving you such command and making such ruling, is calling everyone, is calling all of you towards paradise and Maghfirah bi'idhnihi. Now, the interesting thing about this expression is that God is calling you towards paradise and Maghfirah with His own permission. Well, it doesn't make sense, is it? If you call with His permission, it makes sense. But God calls you with His own permission. It gives a very beautiful twist to the expression. It means that whatever act you do, these acts are embodiment of good acts, embodiment of paradise. Now, we have good acts, we have bad acts. Now, bad acts needs maghfirah. They should be forgiven. Good acts are the embodiment of paradise, are the tajassum of paradise. Now, Allah calls you towards these acts, which brings you maghfirah and brings you paradise. However, none could be done without His leave and without His tawfiq and without His succor. If you do these things, still you need His succor. وَيُبَيِّنُ آيَاتِهِ لِلنَّاسِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَكَّرُونَ. So in this way, Allah clarifies His signs for the people, so that they may take admonition. وَصَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَعَلَى الطَّاهِرِينَ.
Thank you, Sheikh. So we got about 10-15 minutes, well, a little bit more today, to continue the discussion. So any brothers or sisters willing to start the debate? Just a minute. Okay. Yeah, we are ready now. Is anybody? Ready, guys?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Thank you very much for your lecture. Sheikh, we talked about the admonition of marrying the non-believer and how gradually one's values might be changed, and this is quite evident. But just turning to the situation of marriage with Ahl Kitab and the permissibility of men to be able to marry women of the Ahl Kitab, and women not being able to marry becomes problematic in this day and age, because women feel that, why is this the case? What, you know, is it because we are more feeble-minded? What is the reason why women can't be allowed to marry? So that would be helpful if you could explain.
Well, with regards to the context of these verses, I can explain. But what would be the ruling in this day and age? That's to Maharaja, for Maharaja to decide, okay? Because in those days, when a man married a woman, the woman was taken to his family. And rarely they had communication with their own family anymore. And that meant that a Muslim woman was taken to a Christian or a Jew environment. And all the teachings, all the values, whatever they saw morning to evening, it was, of course, the Jewish or Christian worship. Right? So it was most probable that they would have been affected and they would have converted to their faith. Unlike a man, when, for example, they married a Christian woman or Jew woman, they brought it to a Muslim environment. So it was conducive to their faith, to their belief in Islam as well. Nowadays, it's not the case mostly, of course, because couples live separately, usually in apartments and things like that, flats. So what should be the ruling today? We leave it to Maharaja to decide about it. Needs a new ijtihad, probably.
Thank you. Any sisters? Any sisters? Brothers? Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum. How about marrying Ahle Sunnah or any other Muslims?
There's no question about its permissibility.
So it is permissible.
Yes, yes, sure.
Okay, any other brother? Brother? Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Just to clarify this question, I think I asked last week. I think you've explained it, but I just want to be absolutely sure. So a man marries a non-Muslim, not an Ahle Kitab. She converts before marriage, so the marriage is valid.
Yes.
But later on, the woman then goes back to her original faith. So based on what you said, does that mean the marriage is now annulled?
No questions.
Even if she does it in a kind of surreptitious way.
No. As I said, we take people by their words. Right. As long as she has not repudiated her faith verbally, she is regarded to be a Muslim.
But through her actions, for example, if she's from a Hindu faith, for example, and she's still visiting temples.
It doesn't matter. As long as verbally she has not repudiated that,
all right,
we regard her as a Muslim.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
That's for ease, isn't it? Because the law cannot be taken by speculation, cannot be interpreted by speculation, thinking, thought. You see, it should be very clearly mentioned verbally so that we think that it's, yeah.
That's the state of their hearts and so.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. Any sisters? Any sisters? Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum. So how does this apply to just friendships with non-Muslims then? Because I know theoretically like interfaith activities and everything are encouraged and it's good to sort of keep those relations. But then could the same argument not be used that if you have very close friendships with non-Muslims, then actually in the same way you start to see that like, well, I shouldn't, that you know, you value them in the same way that you value someone that's Muslim because you see they have really good values as well. So do you think that starts to affect a person as well? And what's like the recommendation there, even if there isn't a hard ruling about like not being friends with
them? I think that is left to individual judgments rather than such a rule. Because marriage, of course, is a very clear-cut relationship. And therefore, we can apply this ruling. But in terms of friendship, because the degrees of it differ and people may just very easily cut off with friends and things like that or join to friends. So it is left to individual judgment for themselves to decide.
Thank you. We'll go to the brothers before we come to the sisters. So brother there?
Yeah. Salam. Sorry, my question was actually answered already, so I'll pass now.
Go to the sisters, please. Yeah.
Alaykum salam.
No, I think. Can you press?
There's so many young couple, if you try to explain to them. I thought marriage has to be saved at any cost, because there are so many things involved. Children are involved, families are involved. It's, you know, to have it just divorced like that, it becomes very difficult at this day and age. And to make the youngsters today to understand this concept, I find it, because there's so many mixed marriages happening nowadays.
It was even more difficult at that time, because nowadays we don't have much conversions, you know. In those days, I mean, in a household, for example, children converted, parents did not convert, or vice versa. Or in the case of couples, even the daughter of the prophet, who was married to her cousin, who was a mushrik, and they separated from each other. Now, of course, I know there are these controversies about whether the prophet had other daughters than Fatima or not. Or anyhow, the daughter who was under his care. So it happened for his own daughter as well. Before Islam, of course, she married, and after Islam, these rulings came. So I think you said that we save marriage at any cost. We have to think whether that is the case or not. We want to save marriages at any cost. I mean, you remember we discussed last year that لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَفَكَّرُونَ فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. You put dunya and akhira together and then calculate the cost. And in that case, then of course we have a different type of calculation of costs and benefits. And then we have to decide.
Thank you, Nizar. Yep.
So towards solution to all of the discussion we have had, I was just wondering, my first statement is that shouldn't we be regarding all human beings on this earth as Ahlul Kitab? So not only the Jews and the Christians who are the most nearest, but if we go from the beginning of time, I feel every community are Ahlul Kitab. Number one. Now let me finish.
You know, I wish that Allah puts you the guardian of paradise on the day of judgment and you let everyone in. It's very good.
My second statement is that our Maraja community as a whole, past and present, are human beings, not infallible. Salute them for the hard work they've done in whatever judgments and rulings that they do. At times, I salute them even more when they're not sure. They say, it's ehtiyat wajib, so I allow you to refer to any other maraja. Just a hypothetical scenario. If all maraja were to make all the rulings ehtiyat wajib, it would be a very peaceful world.
Now, if all make it ihtiyat wajib, then you cannot refer to any other marja.
So the conclusion of that would be, I can refer to any maraja for any ruling. So I might refer to maraja A for my moon sighting, maraja B for my spouse's religion.
But they have some fatwa. If all are ihtiyat wajib, then you have to follow ihtiyat wajib, you see.
I want the flexibility of being able to follow a marja. I am not saying that I will follow my own ruling. I'll follow a marja, past and present, on any ruling. If everybody is allowed to do that, wonderful, I think.
Now, with regards to your statement that everyone is Ahlul Kitab, what about an atheist who does not believe in God at all? I mean, you cannot, because Ahlul Kitab are those who believe in a book, not those who are born. For example, we have many Jews that do not believe in Judaism at all, but racially they are Jews, okay? They regard themselves to be Jews. They're atheists. Now, do you regard them as Ahlul Kitab, or you do not regard them as Ahlul Kitab? So we cannot say everyone is Ahlul Kitab. Ahlul Kitab are those who follow a book of God. Now, do every nation have a book of God? Now, the only nations we know are Jews and Christians. No, had is different. Now, do they have a book now that they follow? Many of them don't have. So that makes the problem. However, as I said, you know, لعلكم تتفكرون في الدنيا والآخرة. You have to somehow put dunya and akhira together and then calculate. You are very kind-hearted and you want to include everyone in the field of faith and relationship, interaction. But, in some cases we have to allow some, of course, some solidity, some thought in that. And we cannot just give a sweeping ruling about it. And with regards to fatwa, now, you may say that one of the principles may be that we have to follow the easiest all the time. Now, there are some other people who say that, like Akhbaris, they say we have to follow the hardest to make sure that you have followed the ruling of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So these are different attitudes that we have. I hope, inshallah, one magic comes one day that you like and pleases you and you can follow anyone that you like.
Sisters, any sisters? Any sisters now? Brother Riaz? Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Just to add to that, it's not dead in the water yet, because when you apply something like this to different things and you see the sense of it. For example, we were talking about the adoption last week, and in the same way, if you now try to go for the description of non-believer, as opposed to, there is polytheist and there's atheist and there's agnostics.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's now a little bit more out there for you to look at. So we don't have any slave girl problems anymore to issue fatwas for. So in this day and age, we've got this. What we have is these classes of people, atheists, agnostics, whatever you call them. And if you ask them, even people like David Attenborough, he calls it nature. But at the back of his head, somebody has made this nature. It didn't happen by itself. So the mere description of atheism is that a force which is actually being put there by a force.
If Richard Dawkins hears this from you, says that you are attributing a lie against me, I do not believe in anything behind it. So,
oh my God. Did he actually say that?
Well, certainly. Richard Dawkins, of course, he's a very aggressive atheist, isn't he? So,
but surely they know that something has made whatever's out. Isn't it common sense?
You know, they say, surely these who believe, they know that there is no God, but they believe in God.
Yeah, any sisters? Brothers? Yeah, yes.
Sheikh, just to take Nizar's point a step forward, perhaps what we're looking for really, deep down, if we inquire in within ourselves, is we're looking to have a connection with the marja, marjayat. It's very important, because what they say is going to control everything that you do, in every aspect, not just in terms of faith, but in your relationship with the whole world. It's just an existential issue. Sometimes, you know, obviously at all times, when you have that kind of relationship, it has to be based on trust, absolute trust, because you're entrusting your, to an extent, your hereafter to them, you know, because, and they're taking that responsibility, and it's no small responsibility. But then there are a number of issues, perhaps we're more aware of them in the modern age, perhaps maybe they've always existed, that we would question, would a maraja who has been trained for 60, 70 years on Islamic sciences be able to interpret and advise us on issues which have perhaps no immediate connection to Islamic sciences but are in the field of medicine or in the field of ethics and all of those other areas which impact on us, you know, things like, for example, organ donation or genetics and all of these other things which are on our horizon, which are going to impact our lives in many different ways. So perhaps one of the things we might be looking at is a consensus view, a shura of maraja, and within that including experts in these various fields so that they can take advice and then have a ruling which all of them agree to. Whereas I can actually see the dangers within that, because what we don't want, what we do want to allow at all times is independent thought. Because if we put an end to that, that is only for our own destruction. So that has to exist. Yeah. But is there some kind of mechanism you think that might be possible within our lifetimes that would allow that?
Allow that all Maharaja come to consensus or... Well, I mean, in majority of the cases, they have consensus. It's only in certain areas where these disagreements come. And I think this is part of human life. You cannot avoid it. It's in every field you have this. It's not only in the field of jurisprudence. In every field you have this. And it's by just this sort of endeavor and effort that we can come, by having all these different opinions, that finally we can come to a better understanding and better take of the faith, Quran, tafsir, or whatever. So, but to solve this problem, we can say that, okay, among the Maharaja, they have to somehow defer to one authority among themselves, rather than every marja regards himself as an authority in the field, despite they have differences of opinion. But they say, okay, at this time, we all should, everyone should follow this one marja. That is a possibility. And I hope one day comes that this happens, that all the marajas say, okay, we know, all agreed that no one should follow individually any individual marja, but everyone should follow this one marja particularly that we have all agreed about. That is the unifying sort of factor that we can, inshallah, think about.
Just a minute. But there is another person, I think. Okay, fine. Thank you. Bismillah.
I was just thinking, the cardiologists of the world meet once a year. Despite all this availability of social media and communication, they meet once a year to share the research papers. And normally there's a consensus of opinion, and then everybody goes to different parts of the world, back to their universities, back to their hospitals, etc., and adopt that. Yeah, so we've learned something, for example, that this particular drug works particularly well in this particular condition, and the papers were presented research-based. Everybody's happy, everybody goes globally and adopts that. Wouldn't it be nice if all the Maharaja of the world met together once a year, take one specific issue, organ donation, moon sighting, whatever, have a consensus and say to the whole wide world, this is the ruling for the next 12 months until we pick another subject.
Yeah, that's very good. Ideal.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Any sisters before we go back to the brothers? Sisters, no, Safraz, and then...
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Sheikh, sometimes people get very hung up about Maharajas having differences of opinion, but if you look at the very important things, they don't have a difference of opinion, they have consensus. Can you therefore say that where you see a difference of opinion, it's not really a big deal which way you go, because it's not so important a subject, and therefore that they would have differences of opinion because the weight of hadith and whatever could point one way or the other, so therefore it's not that important?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the main elements and principles are always unanimously accepted. Just some offshoots of some questions are problems there.
Well, that would happen because of TV or anything else. There's a problem with the family, not the problem with the Maharaja.
Okay, Riaz, you want to add?
Which was a huge family problem.
In the same house, the Eid is on one day and the father is Eid on a different day. There's an issue. There's a modern.
This is not the problem of Maharaja. This is the problem of family following different marajas. Let them all follow the same marja. Marja.
Yes, you want to tell something? Yeah. Okay.
Sheikh, just to move from
and
this.
And what's
point.
The problem having two Eids instead of one? It's better, isn't it? Sorry.
Sorry, Sheikh. Just to move from that particular issue, and we talked about consensus, and we talked about. You know, having a unanimous decision that people can follow. But what I was trying to allude to earlier, and I want to just explain what I wanted to get to, is the veracity of that decision. That, you know, if, okay, I, because of my the work that I do, my training is on the medical model, and we can talk about like the definition of death, for example. The Islamic definition of death is very different to the medical definition of death. Yes. But it could be anything. It could be about the movement of the celestial bodies, for example, that the understanding is different. And our understanding is constantly evolving. And it's possible that we could go the full circle and come back to the original thinking. Like, let me give you an example. In Surah Yasin, we talk about the sun following its own path. 1400 years ago, people would have laughed at you and said, of course we know the sun is just standing there. What are you talking about, the sun moving? Our belief today is completely different. The Quran was right all along, right? So it's possible that we could go back and say, actually the medical definition of death as it is today, just to give you that example, is no longer true. The Islamic definition was always true. But that interpretation is constantly changing. And how can we be sure, and we talked about trust, how can we be sure that the ruling that the marja has made is correct, in the sense, with no disrespect, I meant in the sense of taking what is contextually correct at the moment?
Well, you know, we have to take what is available to us. We cannot be idealists. This is how we can, I mean, a marja is not a sort of a person born to become a marja. These are our generations. I mean, our children now go to Hawza, study, and they become marja in future. So they are part of our community and part of our struggle to follow, to the best of our knowledge, the law of God. And this is what is available to us. I mean, we don't have anything better. If we can have anything better, okay, we opt for that. But this is what we have. And this is rationally and confessionally, this is the best or the most beneficial option available to us. But we cannot make sure that, yes, it's 100% correct. As the views of scientists, we cannot make sure that it's 100% correct. As you mentioned, scientists at one age believe in one thing, or at another age they come to a different conclusion. So I think we think that marja are special people put aside to be as marja and completely separated from the community and society, and they are giving rulings for us. It's not the case. It's us. It's all us who are trying to find out. And if we say that, okay, we do not follow a marja, we follow our own understanding, then everyone would laugh at us. It says, well, you are not an expert. Why and how you want to follow your own understanding when you are not an expert? So we cannot be sure 100%. Never we can be sure. And that's why the marajim themselves, at the beginning of books of Usul, of course, they confess that this is all based on our own understanding. It's a dhan. No, it's not ilm and yaqeen. Yeah.
Thank you. Any sisters? Zuhair?
Assalamu alaikum. It's not a personal attack, Nizar, but if a patient comes to you and you prescribe him something, and then he goes to another doctor, prescribes something else, and for another ailment, he goes to a third doctor, whatever, after that, you probably will tell him to get lost because you won't want to deal with him. Isn't that the case? You know, if you have a patient, you expect him to come to you at every time. So in the same way, and this applies to all other things, doesn't mean that necessarily you are perfect, but if he's your patient, then you expect him to come to you, not to go around the houses.
But the analogy here is, I'm a mullah, I'm not a mujtahid. So talking about mujtahids gathering together, consultant cardiologists gathering together, whatever they decide, the chief is actually abiding by. If then other chief is not following that, then he's not well-read.
But if
so
you're
talking... mullah have to be well-read, whatever the marja, whatever the council has said, they should adopt it. Otherwise, you get them off the member.
In fact, it should be the other way around, because the point would be that the marajas will actually differ much more, just like the consultants and the researchers will differ a lot more than the lower level consultants. I can't believe that when you say that cardiologism is once a year and everybody accepts one particular thing. I'm sure that there are disagreements.
I understand that the marja themselves do.
What makes you think that they never meet? They do meet from time to time.
Where's the conference? I would love to attend that conference.
Well, it's not for you then, is it?
No, but you know, But if you have attended, for example, or have heard about this Dars-e Kharij, okay, the Maraja, when they discuss an issue, they actually discuss the fatwa of other Maraja as well. They are quite aware what other Maraja have given as fatwa. And they say, okay, Ayatollah such and such has given this ruling. In my opinion, this is wrong, for example, or this is right. So not meeting doesn't mean that they are not aware of each other's fatwa or each other's opinion.
You know, by meeting, there's lots of other things that you know from each other. Networking is so important in this world today. You have to meet. When you attend a conference, you learn more from the people you meet rather than what you hear from the stage, don't you?
I don't know how much it actually would influence their opinions and views. Of course, they respect each other whenever they meet.
You meet people, including me, who will be in the conference. You wouldn't understand what the problems are. Networking is important. Understanding grassroots issues, grassroots problems, were very important.
I think our Maharaja are very much in touch with grassroots because they receive questions from the grassroots on a daily basis. We cannot say that we are more aware of the grassroots problems and questions than the Maharaja, because we don't receive their questions. They receive their questions on a daily basis. So I don't think they are aloof and detached from the grassroots.
Safraj, you want to add something quickly?
That sounds very good. I mean, I like the idea, but there are so many variables that we just are not aware of, and Allah in His wisdom knows better than us. For example, the Shia, and specifically our Maharaja, over history have become targets, and if they ever gathered in one place, they'd be a very juicy target.
Any sisters that want to add anything? Sheikh, just last one from myself, unless there are some others. Talking about the slavery generally, what I understand or interpret is that Islam has not abolished slavery, because we see the rulings that to free a slave to sort of for some kind of a penalty, to pay the penalty, there is to free a slave like that. So the conditions that were prevailing at the time of the Imams or Prophets, where they had the slaves, could the same similar conditions arise nowadays where we can have slaves? For example, jihad, would that arise?
That was an international agreement that the warring parties took the captives as slaves. Now this is abolished, unless we have another international agreement that instead of putting the captives of war in prison, we take them to our houses as our slaves, which is not a very bad idea, of course. People rotting in prison for 15, 20 years of war, coming into society, living with people as a second-class citizen, okay? That's fine. But living, at least living in society. But that needs an international sort of pact, which we don't have now. Yeah, one day if that pact is there, We may come back to slavery.
Sorry.
But so, not the same. You see, we should not confuse this with the slavery of the 19th, 18th, 20th century in the West, you see.
No, I'm not talking about that.
It was a very different idea. It was just going and taking people from their homes, bringing them out to their countries as slaves, as workers. That is never permissible in Islam, never, ever. So it was just, as I said, it was a universal agreement among nations that this is the best way of treating captives of war. Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about those historical slave trade that was going on. But the conditions that were prevailing, and there were slaves during the time of Imam the Prophet, if the similar conditions now prevail, would there be slaves?
As I said, similar condition means that we have a universal convention among all nations. That means it, isn't it?
So no, because as such, Islam has not actually declared that slavery has been abolished, like West
no,
has declared.
No religion has done, neither Christianity nor Judaism has done this, because they have seen this as a sort of social matter which people should solve amongst themselves rather than... But the way the slaves should be treated, of course, is a
but
matter
then why,
of
concern. Why do we have these still the... the rulings that you free a slave for under certain conditions if you want to
pay a penalty. Nowadays, of course, we don't have this
ruling.
Sure,
so
this
why is this still the ruling still going on in the Risala Amalia?
No, even if in modern Risalas, I have noticed, they have actually omitted that.
Oh, is it?
That you either free a slave or fast for 60 days, or they have omitted freeing a slave, of course.
Okay.
It's quite rational to do that, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the information. Thank you. Any other last one from sisters or brothers? No? Thank you, Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So we continue next Sunday, inshallah.